Is there a clicker I can use?
That was a good question.
I'm not sure.
I'll make it work.
Good. It's good to meet you.
Yeah, right. So you joined OGC as an individual member?
I did recently because I've been working hard to try to get Elastic on. We just joined USGIF this year.
Oh, finally. Sure.
And that took a couple of years to get that going. But yeah, I wanted to get the company on. We still may do it, but in the meantime, I was like, I'm gonna join.
Any help in terms of information? And, you know, we obviously have.
That would be great. Yeah, I've been wanting to reach out to you about that actually. The test bed is something that I've been real interested in.
Okay.
I was starting to look at some of the documentation and talking to a few folks that have been involved in that. Of course, we're big in the federal space, and so that came up recently too. So that's one of the reasons I'm really pushing for Elastic to join as a company. So.
Where are you located?
I'm in Dallas.
Is that the main campus?
It's not, campus? No. The main campuses are Mountain View and out in Amsterdam. Those are the two primary. But Austin, they just went ahead and set up some offices there. They got some satellites in New York, all the key places.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, right.
All
the regular customers.
That's right, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, but I started in 2014, and it was pretty much just me doing the geo stuff, and we're up to about 25 people now.
Okay. And you had a background in geo? Or?
Yeah, I got, 2013, I got my PhD in GIS from UTD.
Really?
So, yeah.
Okay.
It was, I worked for Raytheon for 9 years.
The Texas connection.
Yes.
Right.
That's right,
okay.
Yeah. That's actually what kept me down there. I'm from St. Louis originally.
Oh, where are you? So am I.
Are you? Where am I?
Belleville.
Ah, so you're a Cardinal fan?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Awesome.
My wife tells me we live in Baltimore or Minneapolis now for 25 years. She's like, you've got to change. I'm like,
no.
Why?
Yeah. Awesome.
We're here for a good year.
It is. It's turning around.
Yeah, no kidding.
I've been keeping an eye on it every day. And 24 something out of the last 28 or 29.
I saw somebody yesterday hating on the Cubs and how they're going. I'm like, it's too soon. Man.
That's right.
It's too soon. Don't mess this up.
That's right. Yeah, don't jinx it. Yeah, for sure. But I went to undergraduate at St. Louis University Parks College there. And I just saw recently, Andy Deering? I guess he's on the advisory committee for SLU's GIS.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. So, of course, Boundless.
Yeah.
He got bought, but I don't know if he's now separated.
I think he's separated. Yeah. Yeah, but he's an alum, SLU alum. So it's cool to see the St. Louis connection, really.
Yeah. Well, and there's an incubator there. T-Rex for Geosaurus as a geospatial incubator.
That's right. I heard about that.
The NGA stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. That's cool. I
didn't have no idea. And at 10 minutes, I'll give you a 10-minute sign.
Okay.
If you got 10 minutes remaining.
Perfect. Good deal. All right. I guess I'm good to start here. Cool. All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining the talk. My name is Nick Kinnis. I'm with Elastic. I've been with Elastic since about 2014. Started there when they were really small, and of course they're growing, pretty big now. But and then about the same time as when I joined Lucene as a committer, and in the last year I've joined the PMC. So I've spent primarily most of my time, well, actually all of my time there, focused on Lucene's spatial data structures. Changing them and improving them for scalability within Elasticsearch. And of course, I focus on developing out Elasticsearch's geospatial capabilities, and most recently have moved into helping out the Maps team for visualization and all the other products, bringing Geo to the full Elastic stack. Today I'm going to be focused on the data structure, some recent changes within the last year of the spatial data structures inside of Lucene. Spatial's been around Lucene for quite some time, going back to, I think, late 3.something, 4.2, I think, was technically the full release. And then I guess it was about 7.0 that we really started to overhaul the entire spatial data structures. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we did inside of Lucene, the spatial data structures, and then how we bring those to Elastic. So, but I'm going to talk a little bit about, just to start off with, how Elastic uses Lucene, specifically how you can geo-enable an application or your your Elastic geo-enabling application within Elastic. Then I'll go into the actual spatial data structures, which are what's done inside of Lucene, and then talk a little bit about the performance gains that we've seen. So just to kind of start off as a use case application, right? So Elastic tries to keep things simple. Our view inside of the Elastic stack is that geo should really just be another data type, right? So we don't focus on creating kind of a monolithic standalone geo application with Elastic. What we want is we want users to use Elasticsearch to be able to search, query, and visualize all of their data from date timestamps to IP type data, everything that it's been really good at doing, especially for unstructured text-based search, and then just geo-enable that same framework with geopoints and geoshapes. So the idea is that it should all be simple. You shouldn't have a GIS PhD to be able to do geospatial analysis, and we're really focused on trying to keep the APIs simple, keep the user interface simple, and try to bring a capability that somebody doesn't have to turn to like an ARC, Esri ARC stack or a QGIS to do some complex machine learning. So the more we can lower that bar for geo applications, the better. So with that being said, you'll see the APIs are designed to be straightforward. They look exactly like you would create a field inside Elasticsearch for any other data type. We do have geopoints and geoshapes as separate field types, and that we'll talk a little bit about why from a data structures perspective. Lucene actually has optimal data structures specifically for points for keeping the index small. And then we have separate geoshape field, which uses a lat-long shape field inside of Lucene that's been optimized for shapes, but the encoding is a little bit bigger than it would be for points, so your index is a little bit larger. Really, the mindset inside of Lucene Spatial is we treat every computation as a cost, right? So what we don't do is we've actually abandoned a lot of open source geo APIs for this reason, right? We've noticed that a lot of the open source geo APIs are really designed to be kind of be applied broadly. What we do is we've kind of teased out all the really important mathematics and optimized them so that we can minimize the number of computations specifically just for an indexing use case. So that's why we've actually left a lot of our open source packages behind, and we started to implement things specifically inside Lucene. So again, keeping with that simplicity, once you've created your field mapping, then indexing or inserting a document or a point field in that regard should be simple as well. We do accept just latitude explicitly, longitude explicitly, or a comma delimited string, or we accept the multi-valued arrays. We actually push all of our users to do explicit latitude longitude because of the big long-standing argument of should longitude be first or should latitude be first. So we actually explicitly require, we really push customers to explicitly define their latitude and longitude because we've seen a lot of errors and a lot of support cases come in where they've swapped access ordering. So I feel your pain. George, you talked about that earlier today. For geoshapes, I mentioned there was a separate field, and this is where all the pain ensued. This is where we spent all of our time inside support answering these questions. And the reason, it's because of everything you see in blue there. There's these expert parameters that required our users to be somewhat familiar with the indexing structure inside of Lucene, which is all built on top of quad trees and rasterizing vector-based GeoJSON, and having to deal with precision and distance error and trying to keep trade-offs to keep your index small versus when's it going to explode. And that just became a pain point. We wanted to eliminate that as much as possible, and so we'll talk about the structures and how we were able to get rid of that. Everything that was in Lucene before with this quad tree implementation that used Spatial4j is still there as a spatial extra extension, but is not the default anymore inside of Lucene. The new data structures here are. So with that, then inserting a geoshape just uses all of your GeoJSON formats. Complies with the OGC simple feature access specification, which I've read more times than I really care to admit. And we do all of our validation inside of Elasticsearch to ensure that all of your shape data that's provided does comply with that specification. Have really come to respect that specification because the right-hand versus left-hand rules for exterior shells versus interior boundaries is really very well thought out. It makes actually the topology computations pretty straightforward and easy, relatively easy to implement. So we do follow that, and we have implemented specifically inside of Elasticsearch a validation step to ensure that we are compliant with those specifications. So with that, we support all of your points, lines, polygons, and their multivariants. And then we also offer a couple extra ones that are not technically not really part of the spec. Bbox kind of is, but that's only for projections, you know. But we also offer envelopes. And then we've recently deprecated and removed circle. We had a special circle type, which Spatial4j does still accept. The problem with it is it's not a true circle. It rasterizes your circle. So we ran into this problem where we want to be as transparent with the user as possible, and when they were indexing circles, they sort of thought that they were indexing point radiuses when they weren't. They were just indexing rasterized versions of these circles. And so that led to all sorts of precision problems where you'd get false positives in your queries for points that fell outside your circle, and they'd ask why, and we'd get support dev help, and I'd spend more hours trying to explain that to them, and I just got tired of it. So we removed circle, and we've added back in Elasticsearch a circle processor, but we're very explicit that when you give a circle, it's going to vectorize it. So and then we offer up an error value in terms of meters, where you're going to be guaranteed that your polygonized circle is going to be within that error slop factor. So it really sort of forces the user to say, I understand they're not going to be true circles, and I'm willing to accept up to 5 meters error on my polygonized circle. So we do still support the circles, but there is a separate index processor. So let's talk about the data structures. So who has used Lucene? Okay, so again, of course, the history of Lucene is that it was, I think it's one of the longest standing Apache projects, and it was really developed as a text-based search engine, right? So it's a search API, right? It's not a database. It's an API so that you can provide unstructured text, and then it gives all these analysis chains and for all your different languages. And it's great, right? But it was very limiting early on. So if you're familiar with Lucene, you've probably heard of the inverted index, right? It's one of the longest standing data structures optimized for unstructured text. The theory is grounded in the index in the back of a book, right? So you lexicographically sort all of your terms, and then you provide the pages for which those terms would fall on. And it's really as simple as that. Inside of Lucene, there's two data structures that implement the inverted index. That's the terms dictionary and the postings list. The terms dictionary is literally that. It's all of your terms. And it's the terms that have gone through your analysis chain. So if you provide this, you know, first sentence here, let's say that first sentence is the document, the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog, you know, has every single character of the alphabet. We run that through an analysis chain, and that gets pushed into the terms dictionary. And of course, the postings list is just the document ID. And it's a really elegant data structure. It allows you to very efficiently encode these document IDs in what's called bit sets, which is really no different than really long number of bits, and then you just flip the index of the bit to a 1 if that's the document ID that's stored that represents that specific term. So the postings list is just a really long bit set, so it's really compact, and we do all sorts of on-disk compression algorithms for doing like run-length coding and things like that to keep the index as small as possible. Same thing with fast jumping spiders, you'd insert it there. In this case, though, notice these two separate sentences. You're going to have a specific separate term, right, almost for everything. So in this example, I haven't run it through any analysis chain whatsoever. So those terms would just go in verbatim. That's probably not ideal because then you end up with things like the, and it's lowercase and capital. So there's a default analysis chain that will do things like remove stop words, which is your the's, of's, things that show up commonly, and also reduce case, so the capital or lowercase would all become one term, and actually, because it's a stop word, it get removed altogether. So those are ways that the analysis chain can further help reduce the size of the index, but of course there's always trade-offs that you have to make. So depending on your application and what you're trying to search for, you can tweak and tune that analysis chain as much as possible. So cool, the open source community, you know, went bananas with that. That's why it's still, again, one of the longest running ones. But what about numbers? So, gosh, I forget when, you know, a couple of years, 5, 6 years ago or longer, a couple of the committers, Uwe Schindler and a few others, basically wanted to look at how can we bring numbers using the same inverted index. And so that led to using the inverted index like a try, right? So a try is just a prefix tree. So we would take the numbers. So in this case, a really simple representation of integers. It's 4 bytes. There's the binary representation. That binary representation basically becomes your sentence from the previous example. And then we're going to run that through the same analysis chain to create your terms dictionary and your postings list that points to the document that contains that number. So what this led to is it led to a couple expert parameters called precision step or precision, right? So how we're going to run and analyze these numbers is going to be with a precision. If we use a precision step of 1, that basically says this is the number of bits that I'm going to step or scan through my binary stream. A precision step of 1 would be 1 bit. So we'd have for every bit and adding on every bit, we'd have another term in our terms dictionary. Right, so starting off real simple with the first one, 1, you can see 1 points to here and it contains all 5 integers. And I continue down with the next precision step of 1, 0. You now have 2, 3, and 4. And we continue this process until we get through all the bits of my integer. Okay, cool, that works, but Jesus, the index is huge, right? Because now we have for every bit, we have another term, and that's just for 1 integer. So for 1 integer, I'm going to have 32 terms in my terms dictionary times the total number of integers that we want to index. So you can see how this could cause a computational explosion in the size of our index and lead to all sorts of other issues of having to swap on disk and deal with circuit breaker or heap nightmares. So we added that precision step to say, well, if people are willing to sacrifice precision and resolution, maybe we could reduce this. If we use a precision step of 4, then I'm only going to have 4 terms in my dictionary to represent that number. But that leads to all sorts of other problems. Now customers come to you and say, well, shoot, now when should I use 4? When should I use 8? And it kind of goes against all of our whole mantra of simple things should be simple, right? So it pretty much showed that the data structure wasn't optimal, but it worked, so everybody was happy for the time being. Then we said, well, geo people. Notice, you know, there's a crowd of numerics, and the 3 geo people in the room said we want to adapt that, right? And so that's where the spatial 4J kind of came in, and some of the work that David Smiley did was to build on top of this try concept and say, okay, well, all spatial really is in this case then is just going to be a quad tree, right? It's just 2-dimensional ranges as opposed to 1. So how does that look? Well, we've seen a couple presentations that earlier that talk a little bit about this. We use the same concept, but we're going to divide the space, right, the map, along the latitude axis first for the first bit, then the longitude axis, and we just continue, right? We continue to recurse this space, and that's what your space filling curve is. That's just a Morton curve, right? So the reason people like Morton curves or over Hilbert curves and other things is because all it is a bunch of bit flips. It's actually like 5 or 6 operations if you look at it. You can do everything using bit flips and other sorts of, you know, real simple operations. It leads to all sorts of problems, though. So it's not really an ideal case because what it's doing is it's rasterizing your space, right? But anyway, it works. We continue. We divide the space along the latitude, and then notice all the points fall in the northern hemisphere, so all your documents show in as 1. We continue to divide. Now we have 1, 1. We have our 2, and we just continue to recurse. Now you can see that we've basically done a dimensionality reduction down into 1 binary stream. We can now use the inverted index the same way we did for 1-dimensional numerics. And that works. Yeah, it works. But it's got all sorts of problems associated with it. So let's look at that, right? I just talked about circles. Well, what we did with circles, again, they're not true circles. We would rasterize them. And we would rasterize them using the same exact process of a quad tree. But you can continue to recurse this down basically infinitesimally, right? So if I say that I want precision of 3 meters, and I'm doing the entire United States, you're going to end up with a hell of a lot of quad terms and a hell of a lot of terms in your inverted index, and you end up with the same computational explosion that you would do with 1D numerics. But it's worse than that because we're doing a space reduction. We're taking 32 bits of our latitude, 32 bits of our longitude, then we're interleaving them, so you have 64 bits. Now for every cell, we have 64 bits, 64 terms in the terms dictionary, times every cell that has to represent that circle or that complex polygon. And so for 1 shape in 1 document, that's horrible. That's not, you can't scale. It will never solve that big data problem, right? Because you're going to have tremendous amount of data on disk just to represent 1. So we ended up in this problem where we had a lot of users that would just take the political boundary of Russia and forget it. It would melt their servers, right? And so we'd say, okay, well, let's reduce your resolution down to 1 kilometer. But then it got worse, right? So because we had to add all sorts of other parameters I'll talk about in a second. So just to walk through that example, 1, 0, let's say it represents that cell, right? 2, 3, and 4. I think you kind of get it. We recurse down, and that's how we get each one of those. And that's for distance search. And then you run into this bigger problem where all of your boundary cells, you can't just take all the documents because you'll end up with false positives. Some of those documents could be well outside the actual distance that you're searching for. So you have to do a two-phase iterator and come through for all those leaf cells. You have to take every single point that falls in there, and we run a Haversine computation to ensure that it actually is within the distance you specified so we wouldn't get false positives. Tremendously costly, it's basically the Death Star. Okay, cool. Now that's just for points. Let's look at it for shapes, right? Indexing shapes. Shapes work the same way, quad tree decomposition, same way Netscape Navigator did back in the days when you try to download an image off a dial-up internet connection. And you can actually see, I really kind of like this, it's hard to see from back there, but there's a really cool online example of this. You give it any image you want, you specify a resolution, and it will tell you the number of thousands of cells required just to render that one polygon. And then we just add that document to the postings list. So we're happy until the servers melted. We're sad. And now let's look at these other parameters we tried to add to this. It's like adding basically bubblegum to fix an inherent data structure problem. But so inside of Lucene's old spatial way of doing it, we had these tree levels, we had this distance error percent, and then we had another parameter called points only to try to optimize and short circuit all these cells that are being generated for points. The real nasty one is that distance error percent, because that distance error percent has a default of 2.5%. And nobody knew what the hell that meant. Okay, I'm going to give you a shape, and distance error percent is going to be 2.5%. What does that really mean? Well, go read the manual and the documentation. Who really did that? Nobody. And then they'd melt their server, and we'd say, well, change distance error percent. And then they'd finally say, what is that really doing? Well, what it's doing is it's actually computing the diagonal distance of the bounding box of your shape. So take Russia, compute the bounding box of that, compute the distance of the diagonal, and then take 2.5% of that distance, and that's what your slop factor is going to be. So basically what it's saying is I'm willing to accept points that fall with outside my shape within 2.5% of the diagonal of the shape. So it's confusing to explain, confusing to understand. All customers and users knew was I was getting false positives, and they could be upwards of kilometers outside the shape I was actually giving it. And we'd say, well, because you're using too big of a query shape. That's kind of an unacceptable answer. I should be able to use any shape possible and not have to worry about false positives being kilometers outside that shape. So it was a nightmare, but it existed. And if you looked at the old Elastic documentation, you'd see this on our GeoShapes, which just mirrors what Lucene had, right? And so it's like, what the hell? Okay, so we try to bring in the Stooges, and we basically look at the structure, and it's wrong, right? so we hit the books, and there's a really, really nice data structure out there. Some of you may be familiar with it. Everybody knows KD trees, and KD trees are awesome because locale is pretty well preserved. They're really good for like distance and vector distance type analysis. But there's one out there that was a paper that we stumbled across that was really nice for Lucene. It's BKD, which all it stands for is block KD tree. So it's a KD tree structure, but it's designed for on-disk blocks, which is a perfect marriage for all of our codecs inside Lucene, because everything inside Lucene uses block structures for keeping things in local on-disk within segments. Then we have merge algorithms where we try to merge segments as optimally as possible. This is stuff that's been going on since the inception of Lucene. So the fact that there was a KD tree structure that was in the academic literature that said, oh, this is optimized for on-disk blocks, made it really, really attractive for us. So let's take a look at how that worked. Well, it's a KD tree structure, and so we'll just demonstrate that with points, which is really no different than an R tree, B tree. They're all the same. They're all trees, right? It's just how we're going to split and merge each of our internal nodes that makes it different. An R star tree, different from an R tree, different from a KD tree. That's basically it. So I've got a spew of points at the high-level node, and I'd basically take its bounding box, and that's going to be the root node, like an R tree would be. And then I'm going to divide that space once the root node gets to a point that it's just too big for us to search without having linear scan problems and have to look at every single one, right? We're going to have some kind of threshold that's going to cut it off, say we now split that node, and we're going to split based on some heuristics. In our case, inside Lucene, we want those heuristics to be as simple as possible. Things like R-star tree and X-tree and those things try to do some really overcomplicated analysis. They're intended well, but when you're trying to do it at scale, the computation, again, every computation matters. It just starts to add up. So when you try to scale out to millions and millions of documents, it just ends up slowing the split and the merge algorithm starts slowing everything down. So we kept it simple, and we just basically do a resolution calculation of the resolution or of the image itself, right? So the distance of the latitude versus the distance of the longitude. Ratio. Thank you. I couldn't think of the word. We do a ratio computation of it. And so if the x-axis gets to be way far bigger than the y-axis, right, and have these long slivers where we've divided the space, those would be adversarial because you're having to search a lot of linear things based on just the organization of it. So what we try to do is we try to keep it as square as possible. Long slivers get sliced in half, and they continue to get sliced in half until those internal nodes can be as square as possible. And that's about the only heuristic that we really use. Some of these other ones we'll use, like margin calculations and area calculations. We don't do all that, and sometimes it can lead to a suboptimal tree, but that suboptimal tree is still better than a lot of the other examples that we've run into. There we go. So we divide that space out based on trying to keep it as square as possible, and then all the way down, each one of those blocks, those squares, becomes a block on disk, and then our leaf nodes contains each one of those points. What's nice about these tree structures is the fact that it's multi-way height balance, hierarchical tree, so it's logarithmic complexity. That's why people like trees to begin with. But it's log to the base total number of nodes is the complexity of the algorithm. So based on that heuristic, if I have, say, 1,000, right, 1,000 branches at each level, it's going to be log to the base 1,000 number of objects. That's the complexity. So it's easy to calculate. And each leaf node is the same cost to access than any other leaf node. So you don't end up with, like, this having to reshuffle your tree like a binary tree would. The internal node is just the bounding box, like an R tree would be. So it's min y, min x, max y, max x. And then the leaf node for points is simple. It's the y value and x value. So points are pretty straightforward, multi-way. So it's easy, perfectly balanced, and fair to access each one of those. Here's an example of some real data around London. This was using the Planet OSM data set. And we just took basically a slice. So the little measles over on the side is just to show you we try to keep it as square as possible. But also, it splits on the data itself, which is what's it's a nice property of KD trees. Our trees are really kind of succumb to having to know the data really up front to optimally organize your tree. So there's all sorts of other algorithms where they try to buffer as much data as possible before they create the tree structure. You don't have to worry about that so much in KD tree because it does split on the actual data itself. Cool, so that was points inside of BKD, but then and that was released as of Lucene 5.0, Elasticsearch 6.0, and actually became the foundational data structure for all numerics. So all of your date time stamps, all of your integers, doubles, floats, and IP addresses all use BKD, Lucene's BKD structure under the covers as opposed to the inverted index. And then we went and shifted over to focusing on shapes. So how did we tackle the shape within BKD? So we'll talk a little bit about that here. So rather than going through this whole problem that we showed you before where we tried to rasterize the shape, the first thing we wanted to do is we wanted to keep it in vector space. If we kept it in vector space, then we knew we could keep it to the resolution that was given to us as close as possible to the actual pure resolution that was given to us the shape to begin with, right? And so we took a look at how do we keep the GeoJSON in vector space without quadtree rasterizing first so we don't have to worry about any of those resolution parameters. And we turned to the computer graphics literature. And, you know, of course, we weren't the first ones to do this. Mapbox did a really good job with this for all their WebGL rendering. I think it was Vlad actually did a couple talks on how they used a tessellation approach using a ear cut algorithm. We had looked at the same algorithm as well, but so we kind of used something similar, but then we tweaked it optimally for Lucene's block structures. So it uses the same approach where, you know, we sort of sat there and said, look, this is something that's been worked on since the beginning of computer graphics. All your graphics cards are measured in the number of polygons that can be rendered per second. And they use a tessellation approach. And they use this triangular tessellation approach just like your digital elevation models use tens. The reason why they're so nice is because all you have to do is a determinant calculation to compute your collision detection. So it's basically taking all your triangles, and it's a single determinant calculation with the edge of the polygon that you're giving it to determine whether or not they intersect. It's a really nice property. It's really computationally efficient. JTS does a really good job computing your DE9IM matrix to do all of your intersection contains within type calculations, but it also does basically a for loop line scanning algorithm inside there that was one of the reasons that we got away from using the way that Lucene Spatial worked before, because for every one of those quad cells it used JTS DE9IM calculation, and when we would run those through our benchmarking algorithms we were getting billions and billions of calculations just for every single cell trying to create the DE9IM for every single cell that intersects or relates to the query shape. So that's a word of caution. If you want to use JTS to do like side calculations for all of your relations, that's great. It's not good for trying to index at scale millions and millions of shapes, especially if you add that with a quad tree. The computation really adds up. So we wanted to go something simple. We wanted to stick with a determinant calculation, the same way that computer graphics and all your CUDA stuff does on the GPU, and that's the route we went. So let's look at some numbers. When we actually implemented this inside BKD, we wanted to compare it against the old quad tree approach with the inverted index. We're going to start simple and compare it with compare the tessellation with the quad tree approach first. So here's a synthetic shape that was created. Diagonals were created on purpose, obviously, because diagonals are adversaries for a quad tree. You have to get down to the resolution to represent your diagonals. So here's the example. 8 vertex polygon in a 1 degree by 1 degree coverage area. The highest resolution quad cell is going to be 3 meters, is resulting in 1.1 million terms just for that 1 degree by 1 degree 8 vertex polygon. So in your inverted index, take 1.1 million terms, and that's what goes in your terms dictionary, and then your postings list just points to that same document ID. Not hard to see that this doesn't scale very well. So let's look at the same one in tessellation, using tessellation, triangular tessellation, right? Same 8 vertex polygon, 1 degree by 1 degree coverage area. We don't have to worry about resolution because we're staying in vector space. I lie a little bit because what we're doing is we have to encode that somehow and represent it on disk. So our encoding inside Lucene, which I'll talk about in a second, encodes each one of these points, the vertices, as a integer in latitude and an integer in longitude. So it's 62 bits total. Because we're reducing doubles down to encoded integers, we're going to lose some resolution. The encoding approach that we use gets us down to 1.11 centimeters resolution. So if you index a shape inside of Lucene using this approach, you're not perfect double resolution. You're going to be off by just 1.11 centimeters. That was it was a trade we were willing to make. That's pretty dang high resolution. 8 terms. So we went from 1.1 million terms down to 8 triangles, encoded on disk, 8 terms. And so you can see for each shape that has, it's actually a factor of the number of vertices. So if you give us Russia with, I think, has 11,000 vertices, you're going to have at most 11,000 terms. We actually do some optimization where we do some vertice optimization where we remove vertices that are either, you know, really close together and try to do a little bit of trade-offs there to reduce those number of terms. But you will be guaranteed no more terms than the number of vertices that you're given from your original polygon. So if you run the numbers, that's 138,236 to 1 compression from the old way of doing it to the new way. So a smaller, faster index, we're happy. Now, what does that look like on disk? Well, the points were easy because they were just y and x. So how do we represent the tessellated triangle on disk? Because now that's how Lucene represents all your shapes. So if you give us a complex shape in GeoJSON, we tessellate it, and all Lucene knows now is a bunch of triangles that represent that shape. How do we show that on disk? So we did some BKD optimizations, some new features inside BKD, where we wanted to basically say we wanted to add these new dimensions. It's like ancillary data, where we wanted some data added to our nodes that didn't affect the construction of the tree. So that's what the dashed line here is. So inside BKD, a shape or triangle really is represented as a 7-dimension point, where the first 4 dimensions are the bounding box of the triangle. So it's like an R tree, basically, in that regard. So those first 4 dimensions is what drives the construction of your tree. Then the last 3 dimensions of your are data dimensions, or ancillary dimensions that allow us to reconstruct the triangle or reconstruct the data that we're indexing. So we have minimum Y, minimum X, maximum Y, maximum X driving the construction of the tree. And then we have in integer space these bits that we're going to flip. And these bits that we're going to flip are going to do a couple things. They're going to tell us which edge of the triangle is from the original polygon. And we need that so we can do contains queries. We need to know which one is the original one so that when we start accumulating all those shapes from your query shape, anything that contains this shape we need to make sure falls in the right orientation from the original index shape. So in order to do that, we have to know which edge is from the original shape. And then we also use the other remaining, there's actually 3 bits, I simplify it in this chart, but we have 3 bits to tell us which vertex is shared with the bounding box and how can we reconstruct the other 2 vertices. So for this example, it's like a Z curve, right? 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 0, 0 is going to allow us to reconstruct the first vertex as what's being shared with the bounding box. And then all we do is a couple bit flips. We say for X, we can see that that's 1. We're going to flip it to 0. 0 is going to represent minimum X. So to reconstruct the next vertex, we take the minimum X value from our first 4 dimensions, which in this case is going to be negative 10, and the Y value is going to be 5.1. And then for the next vertex, so that's negative 10, 5.1, is along the left. Sorry, I should have highlighted that in this. But on the left line of the bounding box, it reconstructs that vertex. And then the next one, we flip that bit to 0. So we take minimum y inside of our first 4 dimensions, which is negative 10. And then the x value for negative 10 minimum y is going to be 3.1. So that allows us to reconstruct that vertex at the bottom. So in this way, 3 dimensions, we can reconstruct 6, basically 6 coordinate, or 3 coordinates. 3 coordinates, but 6 numbers. So it was an efficient, compact representation on disk, allows us to perfectly reconstruct our triangles, and it only takes integer space of 7 dimensions. So 7 times 4, 28 bytes total for each one of those. And that's what goes into our leaf node. So if we look at BKD now for shapes, where we have all of our internal nodes as just the bounding box of all the bounding boxes of the triangle, so in that regard, it's just like an R star tree. But then the leaf node has this ancillary data that says, well, it's not exactly a rasterized cell. It's a triangle from a vector-based representation of your shape. Here's an example of these states tessellated. I think this one ended up being something like 300,000 triangles. And then we tried to run that through the quad tree. And after about a day and a half, it eventually gave us a heap dump and ran out of memory. So we couldn't even index this in the old way of doing it inside Lucene using the quad tree approach. And then like I said, at query time, so if I'm doing this, you know, real simple polygon query, all we're doing is we're computing which triangles are actually going to intersect with that polygon. And it's extremely efficient because all that is a determinant calculation of the edges with your triangles. So that was released as of Lucene 7.6, I think, is what it was. And then we just recently, as of Lucene 8.2, have adapted the tessellation and all of your geoshape queries. We've now adapted them to not be geospecific into a new field called XY-shape. And XY-shape takes any Cartesian geometry whatsoever, uses the same approach to tessellate those. And indexes those, and actually we're adding right now support for the third dimension. So this way we can take any geometry whatsoever in three dimensions, tessellate them down into their triangles, and then index that. So we've done some experiments with digital elevation models, tins, things of this nature. Those can all be indexed inside of Lucene, and then you can start doing three-dimensional analysis or queries just based on that, those index triangles. Some benchmarks. Let's look at some benchmarks here. The key one there is the purple line. So that purple line right there and the blue line at the bottom. Everything else in between, there's a couple other fields that we offer. The red is something that's called Geo3D. Geo3D is an indexer inside Lucene that does everything in Earth Center, Earth Fixed. I think it was developed by a gentleman at Here Maps, which works well for the resolution for what they need. But it's called Geo3D, but that's kind of a misnomer. It's not 3D models or anything. It just means that it's Earth Center, Earth Fixed. So it's X, Y, Z in meter space. And then all of your shapes and points are doing everything inside that coordinate system. For this perspective, the only thing you really care about is that purple line again, that blue line. That blue line is points. That purple line is shapes. Where you see the drastic drop in late October 2018 is where we switched from using double encoded triangles down to the integer encoded triangles that I just showed it on the previous slide. It ended up being something like a 40% decrease in your index size. And then that blue is points. So you can see that the size of the index for shapes is not that much different, or it's not that much greater than points, which is really nice. We couldn't even benchmark this against the old spatial way of doing it because, like I said in that previous example, we had shapes from Planet OSM that just didn't even index. And then indexing time. Again, the purple line and the blue line is what you care about. When we switch to this whole dimensional BKD optimization where we had these ancillary data dimensions versus the bounding box, sort of switching over this archery approach, that's where you see that jump in that purple line spiking all the way up in early or late January of 2019. And what's really nice about this is when we added that encoding optimization. So what's really nice here is that our shape indexing now today is far faster than where our point indexing was even just about 9 to 10 months ago. The nice additional property of that is that our points took a boost too because we made this optimization to the BKD structure in general. So that gave us a nice performance boost for both points, shapes, and numerics.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Just some feedback here that we got. That Russia polygon, there's the numbers. The one Russian polygon, we had a shard on a node that had 16 gigs a heap. It was running on that Russia polygon for 4.5 hours. For 4.5 hours in that example, with about 2 kilometer spatial resolution, is now finished in less than a second at 1.11 centimeter resolution. And then Esri Arc Online, everything for Arc Online in the back end for the indexing uses Elastic and Elasticsearch, so they're a pretty big customer of ours. They went and did some benchmarks with the new encoded version on BKD, and they got a 25 to 30 time performance boost and with a nice added benefit of getting 1.11 centimeter resolution. So those were some nice feedbacks from people who actually put this into practice. And then all those parameters, when we started this talk, all went away. So we're happy now. We're down to that simplicity. Things should be simple. Geo shapes, 1.11 centimeter. Nobody has to worry about this resolution property. Nobody has to worry about the distance error percent nastiness that happens on the back end. You just say geo shapes. You give it a GeoJSON. You know that it's going to be 1.11 centimeters. And then off you go. So what's next? Some use case applications. I mentioned XY shape came out in Lucene 8.2. We actually just released that in Lucene 7.6. We have a couple customers. Samsung is one of them that's using it to index all of their circuit board diagrams, all their CAD drawings, and running queries across all their circuit board diagrams. Orlando Universal Studios theme park uses Elasticsearch on the back end. They were doing all their localized mapping in using the old shape approach. They're switching over to XY shape to do a local coordinate system to map all of the Universal Studio theme parks. We have a sports analysis, forget which company it was, did a bunch of sports analysis. Well, actually, Chicago Cubs use use Elastic also for a lot of their data analytics, where they're taking, if you're a baseball nut like I am, they actually coordinate map where every single play occurs on the baseball diamond. And they're starting to switch that over to XY shape as well. And there was another customer that analyzed Sidney Crosby's slap shot, where they were using basically the GeoPoint type approach and creating heat maps to show where Sidney Crosby has a tendency to do, you know, slap shots as compared to a few other players, which is pretty neat. Virtual gaming, things like that. Blizzard is an Elasticsearch customer, and they're switching over to that to do some of their virtual gaming environments rendered inside Elasticsearch to do God knows what with. I don't really know off the top of my head. And then cybersecurity and some applications within our SIM application is switching over to the XY shape to ingest all the network diagrams to do more cyber type analysis in a spatial domain. So that was available as of... I'd say Lucene 8.2, that's actually Elasticsearch 7.6. And then now we've got a prototype that's getting ready to go into Elasticsearch Beta 8.0, where thanks to Proj4j and a few other things, we're able to index in other coordinate systems using these foundational data structures inside Lucene. So you'll now be able to add the coordinate reference system as part of your mappings and be able to do things like in UTM zone 14 or whatever coordinate system that you're in. It will actually index it in that native coordinate system. And then we have a ingest processor which will automatically can reproject that to any other coordinate system that you want. So if you want to, if you have data that's in native, say NAD27 oil and gas, you want to index that inside of Elasticsearch without losing resolution. You can index that in one field and then use ingest processor to reproject on the fly to any other coordinate system for other visualization. So our maps application is doing that for WGS84 so that they can visualize everything in Web Mercator. Until they can support other projections natively. And then where we're going with that beyond 2D, BKD right now supports up to 8 dimensions, which is largely arbitrary. We've made some on-disk encoding improvements where we're looking to expand that out to 255 dimensions. And the reason we selected 255 is because 255 seems to is about the right sweet spot for hyperspectral image ingest and hyperspectral image analysis. So you can imagine for like government applications, hyperspectral imagery, we want to be able to provide ingest processors and index all that imagery data. And then LiDAR is another field that we've been working on internally for being able to ingest LiDAR data sets inside of Elasticsearch and then visualize them using the Maps application. I only have a couple minutes here, but I did want to touch on some aggregations because the aggregation framework in Elasticsearch is effectively the foundation for doing all of your analytics. There's some real simple ones, but this is kind of set the stage for where things are going. Geodistance aggregation for doing bullseye analysis. So here's an example of that where you can specify spatial ranges. On the back end, it uses Haversine computation, so it's doing everything that it possibly can to stick to the curvature of the Earth. So it'll plot all your points within some custom bullseye, and it will score them and sort them appropriately, so you'll get relevant search results that are, say, within a specific distance of your location. So that's really good for, you know, mobile phone type search analysis and use cases. GeoGrid aggregation is something that's been there from Elasticsearch, I think, 1.0, but it was using geohashes, which is really, really bad in terms of resolution. So we switched that over to QuadTree before we added BKD, and then we've recently added a GeoTile one. But GeoHash grid aggregation or GeoGrid aggregation is what drives Kaban on the back end for doing all the choropleth mapping and the heat maps. Under the covers, that's an Elasticsearch GeoGrid. And then, like I said, as the 7.0, we released the GeoTile aggregation, which sticks with the Web Mercator, so you can have more accurate results on top of the Kaban map. And then sort of patchwork prior to that one being available was a geocentroid aggregation. This does a weighted spatial distance computation. So the way aggregations work is we have bucket aggregations and we also have metric aggregations. Think of bucket aggregations like classification type analysis and metrics as like scripts. So like your ST distance type scripts would be your metric aggregations. So a geocentroid aggregation is a metric aggregation that can be added on to any bucket aggregation. And what it does, it would take all those points or the centroid of all those shapes and compute the weighted distance so that you get a more accurate centroid within that bounding box or within the result of the bucket. So let's look at an example of that. So notice down here, like you can see the geohash grid aggregation around Miami does not really align with Miami or Fort Lauderdale. It's way out in the ocean. You can add geocentroid aggregation to that, and all your points will be pulled in snug exactly where the where the cluster is spatially weighted. And then the other real cool one that we added is a new class of aggregations called matrix aggregations. And the first one is a matrix stats aggregation. And what this does is it takes multiple fields from Elasticsearch and allows you to do Pearson's correlation coefficient as well as the Pearson's product correlation as well as your correlation coefficients. So so here's an example using population data. Let's just take two fields, name and income. And what this will do is if you run the matrix stats aggregation, it's going to give you your variance, your skewness, and kurtosis of the data itself. And then it gives you the covariance matrix and the correlation matrix, which is really nice because once you have that covariance matrix, you can do a decomposition of that. And then you can actually start doing things like principal component analysis, which is where we're starting to head for our vector fields. So we're using matrix stats aggregation to run our covariance matrices, and we're doing a decomposition, eigenvalue decomposition over that to give the values of which dimensions carry the most signal so that you could re-index, say, a 120-dimension data set down into its four or five principal components. And all that's going into our machine learning product as well. So that's where we've got a prototype that's looking to be released probably in one of the next major versions for PCA for doing dimensionality reduction, things like image analysis, facial recognition. And then we're taking, it's not hard to see with this, since we have correlation and covariance matrices, we can start doing that with spatial weight matrices. And that's what goes into things like Moran's Eye for measures of spatial autocorrelation and your Geddes-Ord computations for doing hotspot analysis. And so we're trying to provide these as foundational aggregations inside of Elasticsearch to do some more advanced GIS type analysis. But then what that'll do, what that will enable is our MAPS application to start bringing things like a spatial analysis toolkit to be able to run online. And that's an example of a lot of those aggregations put together for analyzing real-time flight analysis. I was thinking about doing a MAPS demo, but I didn't want to tempt the demo gods and all that. But now, and you can see plenty of videos out there from some of our latest releases if you want to see that demonstration. So, cool. That's it. Follow for updates. And, of course, Apache Lucene Solar is where the project lives. You can keep an eye out there.
So you mentioned about most of the things are about Elastic, but I do see Lucene Solar. So is it also getting all the goodness into Solar?
Yeah, all the data structures are in Lucene. Everything that I talked about with BKD, spatial, all that stuff is inside Lucene. The aggregation framework is Elastic, which is Apache licensed as well. That's all open source. Everything I showed you is actually part of the open source version of Elastic, which is all Apache licensed. Yeah, everything up there is Apache licensed. I think that's one of the latest part of the latest buzzes, of course, with AWS and Elastic and all that. And Elastic's moves are now having a basic type license, which is true, but most of the geo-foundational bits that you're seeing here, that's all going to stay open source. And then some of the more advanced, like machine learning stuff, where we're going to do like anomaly detection on spatial data, that stuff will probably be more basic license. But the foundations will stay open source. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it sounds like a dumb question, but so when you're over what is the measure of similarity between? Because you were talking about making sure that two vertices are connected together in your KVD in your BKD model.
Yes.
So when you're over x and y, so let's z. When you're over two dimensions, what is the measure of similarity?
In turn,
that two vertices are close to each other when you're in more than.
Oh, you're talking about like reducing noise or reducing duplicate exactly. coordinates? The similarity measure is just using Haversine computation for distance. That's it. It's looking to see how far the points are from each other.
Okay.
But that's also, most of that optimization is inside like ingest processor. We try not to remove data because that's just not good. We don't want to take data away from a user. We don't want a user to give us a shape and then say, you know, come back on the back end, surprise, we removed a bunch of your vertices from you. So we don't do that right up front. That's a parameter that you can add to say within this distance measure, I'm willing to sacrifice some level of resolution.
So if you want to extract like from a 3D, let's say a 3D map, and you want to extract a box, so like a rectangular shaped box.
Uh huh. The distance computation is using Haversine. We do some kind of thresholding there to determine whether or not they're the same, but we don't do that by default. So, any other questions? Yes. Yeah, so the BKD back geoshapes landed in Lucene late 2018. So everything that you saw in the data structure, the tessellation and all that, that was all of Lucene 7, I want to say 7.5. It's all out there as of late 2018. And then the XY shape just landed in Lucene's last release, 8.2. So if you want to do Cartesian, any Cartesian geometry, you can use XY shape inside Lucene 8.2. If you want to do lat-long shape, latitude, longitudes, it's WGS 84 inside the lat-long shape one. That was all 7.4, 7.5 above. Yeah.
3D shapes. You talked about going to 3D dimensions.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, we're looking at that. That's a tough one, which it's doable because we're going to create basically a prism, right? The triangular prism. So like Collada models and things like that, you'd be able to index. That's something we'd like to do, but it's going to be a little bit further longer term. 3D in terms of like elevation models and tins and stuff.
Surface there in 3D,
yeah.
But it's a 2D surface.
Correct. 3D. Yes. Yeah. That'll be out. I would expect probably the next major Lucene release. Of course, you know, I get in trouble every time I say a version, so take that with a grain of salt, but yeah. That's a relatively easy one because the tessellator already supports it. It's just a matter of our encoder supporting that third dimension. Yeah.
Cool, very good.
Any other questions? Cool.
Very good, thanks.
Thank you.